after considering some of these prima facie duties and how these prima facie duties work with one another, and having thought about how this list of prima facie duties pans out, and whether or not we can consolidate some of these things, or whether anything needs to be added or subtracted from this list of prima facie duties, I think we need to consider a few things further and move on to finalizing what Ross has gotten at here. In this discussion between prima facie duties of beneficence and non-maleficence, or of self-improvement or justice, these sorts of things, I think one thing that is oftentimes not really considered when you're talking about, for example, beneficence versus non-maleficence, is that you're thinking of, or you might be thinking of, beneficence and non-maleficence as maybe being consolidated because, as of course Ross himself says, the helping of someone is obviously at the same time not hurting them, right? And so you may be thinking that you can consolidate beneficence and non-maleficence together because you can say, well, okay, well, I have a duty to help, you know, Bill, then obviously by helping Bill, I am also at the same time not hurting him. And if I hurt him, then I am obviously at the same time not helping him, right? So therefore, why do we need beneficence and non-maleficence as separate duties? Well, that's all well and good, but one thing that you may not have considered is that when we are dealing with these sorts of duties, when we're dealing with beneficence versus non-maleficence, it might be the case, because remember, we're talking here about what to do when we have duties that conflict with one another. So you may be thinking, well, beneficence and non-maleficence could never conflict, right? Because when you're helping, then you're obviously not hurting, and vice versa. However, one thing you might not have considered is, what happens when my duty to help Bill conflicts with my duty not to hurt Sally? In other words, just because helping one person is the same thing as, or at least includes, not hurting that same person, what happens when I have a duty to help one person that may conflict with my duty not to hurt someone else, right? So maybe I have a duty, a prima facie duty, to help Bill, but in so doing, I will hurt Sally. Well, okay, now we have a decision to make about which one of those weighs more. Does the duty not to hurt Sally outweigh the duty to help Bill, or does the duty to help Bill outweigh the duty not to hurt Sally, right? So it seems, Ross himself says, the more stringent duty, the more important duty in most cases seems to be non-maleficence. So unless, of course, the help to Bill would be massive and the hurt to Sally would be minuscule, probably my duty to not hurt Sally would outweigh my duty to help Bill. And because these two things can conflict, maybe we do need both. Maybe we do need both of them on the list, as Ross says. Now, when we're considering something like justice, remember we're talking about justice as, for Ross, is fairness. Now, basically what Ross is saying is that we should have these means to certain goods, and these things should be properly distributed, right? He says they should be distributed according to merit. And I stressed this last time when we were talking about this, that that does not mean equal. Justice does not mean equal. Justice means fairness. Now, that sounds all well and good, of course, right? And some of the way you might have been thinking about this is that, well, yeah, of course, you know, justice sounds great. And I think, indeed, that it would be hard to find someone who disagrees that people should get what they deserve. I mean, that's sort of obvious, I suppose. It's almost a platitude. The problem is, it's a little bit too obvious. It's a little bit too much of a platitude. It doesn't really tell us anything. Sure, it's all well and good to say people should get what they deserve, right? And I think I would maybe go out on a limb and wager that we might all agree to that. We might all agree that people should get what they deserve. But of course, if you ask 10 different people how to figure out what people deserve, you're probably going to get 10 different answers. Right? We may well all agree that people should get what they deserve, but what do they deserve? Well, that's not so easily answered, is it? Some people think people deserve things for various reasons, and they disagree on what those reasons are. Maybe you think working hard means you deserve certain things. Other people say, no, don't work hard, work smart, right? The things that you do, the less effort you expend to achieve the same result, well, that's in a way admirable. Working hard just for the sake of working hard is sort of silly and doesn't mean you deserve anything more. Working smarter means you deserve more. Some people think they deserve more just because of their social situation, right? How do we figure out, in other words, what it is that people deserve? We may all agree that we should get what we deserve, but I mean, that's just almost a tautology. It doesn't really say anything. What is it that we deserve, and how do we figure out what we deserve? Not a very easily answered question. And it means that while it might make sense to have justice on our list of duties, and it might make sense to agree that we should endeavor to be just, this question of what justice is, that we've been actually approaching several different times through the course of the term, is sort of left open, and there isn't a clear way of deciding such a thing. Now, finally, the duty on this list of prima facie duties that probably garners the most attention, at least as far as disagreement, is self-improvement. We talked about this a bit when we were talking about Mill, for example, and we're on this list of higher order versus lower order goods, and one of the things I asked was, you know, what if I just don't care about these higher order goods? Who are you to say I should? And a similar question can be asked with respect to the prima facie duty of self-improvement. Ross says I should improve myself. I have this duty to improve my state. Now, why? I mean, what reason can we give for that? I mean, again, what if I'm someone who just says, look, Ross, if I am not interfering with anyone else, if I am living up to my other duties, if I am helping people when I can, if I am not hurting them, if I am causing no harm, if I am not standing in the way of other people's successes or whatever it is, then can you really say I'm doing something wrong if I'm simply not improving myself? If my choices only ever negatively affect me, and I'm happy to take responsibility for those choices, then in what way can you say I've been doing something wrong? After all, I mean, I should be able to choose how my life goes, right? I mean, what if I don't care about these so-called improvements? What am I to say, or what is Ross to say to something like that? Now, this basic idea here is, look, if I am trying to think of morality in terms of duties, right, and that the duties are essentially revolving around the notion of not bringing bad into the world, right? I mean, I should not harm people. If you think of morality in that way, that if I'm not bothering anyone, if I'm not making anyone's lives worse off, if I'm simply doing what I want to do and I'm not affecting anyone other than myself, or at least I'm not negatively affecting anyone other than myself, then I should essentially be allowed to my own devices. I should be allowed to do whatever the hell I want to do. If I want to shoot heroin into my eyeballs and eat Cheetos in the basement playing video games all day and I'm not hurting anyone else, then who are you to say I'm doing something immoral or morally lacking? In other words, self-improvement should be off the list. Now, what can someone like Ross say in response to this? Well, there's a few things. Think about it on your own for a moment. But there's a few things Ross could say about this. First off, you could say something along the Mill lines that the value of these so-called higher-order goods certainly would outweigh these other things, these desires for these short and fleeting pleasures that I may be after. You could say something like, well, these other duties that we have, the other duties on the list, are much better performed, much more easily performed, if you improve yourself. In other words, one way you could attack this attack on self-improvement is to say that self-improvement is maybe a prerequisite for bettering your response and your ability to perform these other duties. In other words, if you do shoot heroin into your eyeballs and eat Cheetos and play video games all day, then you're not very well equipped to perform the duties and uphold the duties of non-maleficence and beneficence and justice and all the rest. That you have to make yourself an improved, better person in order to better accomplish your other duties. Now, that may all be very well and good, but we still have this other looming question here as to how are we supposed to decide. Because the whole idea behind this prima facie duty list is to say that there are going to be duties that conflict. There are going to be these questions that arise. There are going to be cases where I have to make, in fact, maybe it's most moral decisions I make are like this. There are going to have to be these cases in which I have to make a decision about which of these prima facie duties I should uphold or follow or perform in any given circumstance. Because in many circumstances, there will be conflicting duties. My duty to beneficence might conflict with my duty to justice or whatever else. So, how do we do this? And that's where the break between prima facie duties and actual duties comes into being here. Remember about the prima facie duties, the list, that list of prima facie duties. The reason we can know those things, according to Ross, is that they are self-evident. It's the mere fact that you have, the example he kept giving, it's the mere fact that you have made a promise that adds or gives moral weight to that promise. You know that there is moral weight to keeping your promise for the simple reason that you've made a promise. That's enough. That's it. That's enough to show that there is moral weight to the keeping of the promise. It's self-evident. You know it because it's self-evident that there is this duty that you have. Actual duties are not like that. Actual duties are not self-evident. You don't know them simply by thinking about them. You have to weigh these different duties by their moral weight. Remember, he says there are going to be undoubtedly those cases when the keeping of a promise would be so detrimental, would be so damaging, would be so costly that the right thing to do would be to break the promise. Those cases, he says, no doubt we have to admit those cases exist. So, the actual duty is the thing that you should actually do, right? It's the actual duty that wins, as it were, in a given scenario. Now, that's of course up to deliberation. You have to weigh these prima facie duties and find out which one weighs more. So we've talked about this example before. You know, I promised to meet you for lunch, and on the way I see this small child drowning in the shallow pond and so on, and I have a duty to help the child, and I also have a duty to keep my promise, the duty to fidelity to keep the promise, the duty to beneficence to help the child, and so on and so on. Which one weighs more? Well, in this case, it's sort of obvious, right? This is an extreme case. My promise to meet you for lunch is a rather light promise, a lightweight promise, right? I mean, it's nothing that the world hinges on. It's a meeting that we're supposed to have. We're not supposed to be talking about, you know, marvelously important business or anything. It's just a meeting. We just haven't been able to get together, and we promise to do so. Obviously, in this case, the life of the child weighs morally much more than keeping my promise does. Fair enough. But what about the cases there that are a little bit closer, right? Do I have a duty strong enough on one way to outweigh my duty the other way in slightly more everyday scenarios? I mean, it's not an everyday thing. I hope that none of us will ever have to make such a decision to break the promise or save the child, but I wouldn't doubt that the decision would be a fairly easy one to make. But we have harder decisions to make in our everyday lives, right? Do we help a family member who is suffering, even though we think that helping them may just add to their suffering, right? A family member is a drug addict, for example, and they won't go seek help, but they're also homeless and out on the streets because they've spent all their money on drugs. Do we give them money? They say they want to use it for shelter, food. Do we know that? Maybe they'll use it for drugs. Do we help them? Do we give them money? Do we not? Do we try to do something else? Do we force them into rehabilitation or something like that? I don't know. When you're making a decision about how to act, when you're making a decision about which career path to follow, maybe your parents want you to follow a certain career path. Maybe you have sort of an aptitude for one kind of a path, but your passion lies down another career path that is perhaps not, your family is not a fan of, or is perhaps less likely to result in a successful career, but it's your passion. Which path do you follow? These more everyday kind of decisions to make, these decisions that are closer, where your conflicting duties are closer and it's not so obvious. How do we do that? How do we weigh those things to figure out where our actual duty lies? Because that's what the actual duty is. The actual duty is which of the conflicting prima facie duties that weighs the most, morally speaking. Now, if you have no conflict of duty, if there's just one prima facie duty in play, well, then that's just the actual duty, right? But when you have conflicting prima facie duties, the actual duty is the one that weighs the most. Which of the prima facie duties weighs the most? Which matters morally the most? And how do we make such a decision? Well, one obvious way to do it is to say, well, the way that we compare them and weigh them against one another is consequences, right? Whichever one has the better consequences, that's the one that weighs morally more, and that's the thing we should do, right? After all, that way we will have a view in Ross that is part duty and part consequentialism, part deontology, part consequentialism. You have the prima facie duties, and when they conflict, you then weigh them, right? You weigh them by their consequences and see whichever one is the best. And do that. Sounds great, right? So it's duty stuff, until duties conflict, and then we weigh them consequentialist style, and then we have our moral answer. Now, that sounds fine, and sort of, but it's not really the way Ross wants to do it, and it's sort of obvious why he doesn't want to do it that way. Because if we're going to do it that way, if we're just going to think of these things in terms of when they conflict, we turn to consequences, well, then why are we being Ross? If that's all it is, then what was wrong with Mill? Why aren't we just consequentialists? I mean, if there isn't a conflict of duty and it's just obvious what we should do, then we don't really need a moral theory to help us, right? The situations that we need a moral theory to help us are the ones that are more difficult. They're the ones where there is conflict and we have some sort of decision to make. Those are the ones when we turn to a moral theory to help us in our decision making. And if we turn to Ross's moral theory, and that's what Ross's moral theory means, just weigh the consequences, then it's just consequentialism. It's just consequentialism with some duty talk thrown in. It's just consequentialism said in a different way, but it doesn't really change anything. It's just Mill. Just be Mill. Why do we need Ross? Just be Mill, if that's the way we're going to do it. There's no improvement here. There's no added extra anything. But if we don't want to use consequences, if we don't want to just go back to being Mill, and we want to say that Ross actually brings something to the table, and the way we discover, the way we choose our actual duties is different than the way I'm suggesting here with just being consequentialist, then what other metric do we use? How else do we make this decision? What other measurement, what other sort of weighing system? Is it something that just is a feeling that we have? This weighs more than that in this situation? Well, no, that can't be it either, because Ross actually himself says there is no self-evidence about actual duties, and there is an actual duty in any given situation. There is an objectively morally correct thing to do. And if there's an objectively morally correct thing to do, then that means it can't just be based on an individual subjective feeling. I just feel like in this situation, this duty weighs more. No. There is an actual right answer. Which means, of course, we can get it wrong. If there's a situation when you have a conflict of duty and you decide to follow one duty rather than the other, you could get it wrong. There is an actually objectively correct, morally correct answer in every moral situation, according to Ross. If it were just subjective, based on the way you feel, then you wouldn't be able to get it wrong. And if you wouldn't be able to get it wrong, then of course it wouldn't be Ross, it would be relativism. And that's, as we've already seen, fraught with difficulty. All sorts of logical problems with such a view. So what then? What sort of method of measurement, what sort of weighing mechanism can we use to make the decision about which of the conflicting prima facie duties weighs the most in a given situation? That's the million-dollar question. If we can answer that, and I would like you to think about it, but if we can answer that, then maybe we have a system in Ross that is actually useful, that successfully manages to take elements from deontological theory and consequentialist theory and bring them together into a single unified moral theory that takes the better bits from both and leaves the worst bits from both on the cutting room floor. If we cannot, well then, maybe we end up with nothing more than a valiant attempt at an amalgamation, at a bringing together of these views, but really nothing more than a valiant effort. So, as we see in Ross, we have then this really interesting approach. Whether it's successful or not, well, I don't claim to have any sort of objective answer to that, but it is nonetheless a very interesting attempt. So, there have been others, by the way, who have attempted to bring these kinds of moral theories together. There have been those who have tried to show that we can have a moral theory that takes deontology parts and consequentialist parts and bring them together. Ross is one of the more well-known attempts, and I'll leave it to you to think about it and decide if you think it is a successful one.